to VOA 1, the hits.
Billboard, baby.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Jill Robbins and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, a Christmas tree stands near the intensive care room of a COVID-19 patient. He lies unconscious, connected to a machine that breathes for him. A few feet away, a plastic snowman hangs near the room of another patient who is also on a ventilator. The holiday decorations at East Alabama Medical Center let family members know that we're trying and we love these patients, said nurse Carla Fallon. We want them to feel like it's Christmas as much as we can, she added. Nurses and doctors who have spent months caring for sick people are doing what they can to get through the holiday season. They worry people will hold gatherings, travel, and take part in other activities that could add to the current wave in COVID-19 cases. Fallon has been a nurse for 5 years at the hospital in Opelika, Alabama. She says the decorations help lighten the mental load in the ICU. A sharp rise in infections linked to Thanksgiving gatherings is now filling up beds at the hospital. Vaccines are on the way, but not yet available to the general public. Hospital officials are worried about what might happen in January after holiday travel and celebrations are over. When so many are suffering, even a picture of a candy cane on an ICU window can help. Dr. Misha Wallace is a lung doctor who works with patients in serious condition. Families come in, and all they're getting, for the most part, is bad news, she said. A little bit of Christmas cheer is not going to hurt. It can only help. Wallace is not attending her usual Christmas gathering of about 30 relatives. She hopes to spend the holiday with an aunt who might drive from Atlanta, Georgia, if neither of them shows signs of COVID-19. Dr. Ricardo Maldonado leads the pandemic team at East Alabama. He knows exactly what he will do for the holiday. Work, Maldonado said, after visiting patients on a hospital floor full of COVID-19 patients. There is so much work. The nonprofit hospital has had to add about 60 nurses to its workforce to meet the increased demand. But East Alabama Medical Center's chief, Laura Grill, said neighboring states continue to ask the hospital to take in some of their sick. Some East Alabama employees got sick with COVID-19, Grill said. Others retired from their jobs or just left. Many, she said, are suffering physically and emotionally from extreme tiredness.
Reports of attacks on Eritrean refugees
in Ethiopia's Tigray area are causing concern among human rights groups. About 96,000 Eritrean refugees lived in four camps in Tigray before the conflict started in November. Many fled to Sudan or to other parts of the country, including the capital, Addis Ababa. Sarah Miller is with Refugees International, an independent group working to support refugees. She said Eritreans are being picked up and returned to Tigray or to their homeland against their wishes. There's a lot of concern that Eritreans are being forced back to places where they would be in danger, she said. Miller added that could be inside Ethiopia, in Tigray, or even in Eritrea. Miller told VOA the reports are coming in from refugees, family members, and non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, that are active in Ethiopia. Chris Meltzer is part of UNHCR's emergency team in Ethiopia. He told VOA that his organization did not have permission to return to the four refugee camps in Tigray. However, there is once again food aid at two of the camps. He too is concerned about reports of violence against refugees. We are aware of many stories about killings and abductions from the camps, he said. He added that UNHCR cannot confirm the stories now, but if they are true, it would be a violation of international law. The issue has gotten the attention of U.S. officials. In a joint statement, U.S. Senators Cory Booker of New Jersey and Todd Young of Indiana demanded that all parties in the conflict follow the law and protect civilians. They asked that Eritrean soldiers permit refugees to flee violence. We are deeply concerned by reports of Eritrean refugees in Tigray being killed, abducted, and forcibly returned to Eritrea by Eritrean forces, as well as disturbing reports that some trying to reach safer areas are being prevented from leaving, the senators said. Recent reports suggest that Eritrean soldiers have been involved in the Tigray conflict. Reuters says five diplomats have pointed to evidence of soldiers on the ground from satellite pictures, communications, and reports from Tigray. A State Department spokesperson told VOA there are believable reports of Eritrean forces harming refugees and preventing them from getting to safety. All parties must respect human rights and international humanitarian law, the spokesperson said. I'm Jill Robbins.
Many Americans experience surprise or disappointment when they wake up on Christmas Day. They might be surprised or disappointed by a family member's actions. They might be happy or unhappy about a Christmas gift. Imagine a child expects to get an Xbox or PlayStation for Christmas. On Christmas morning, they quickly open their gift. Inside is an English grammar book. They might feel disappointed. The Everyday Grammar team would prefer the new English grammar book. But if you are like most young people, you would probably rather have a new video game system. Today, we are going to explore those feelings of surprise and disappointment. In other words, we are going to explore how speakers show that reality was better or worse than their expectations.
Many languages use words to express expectation. Speakers also use words to express how events are not happening as expected. This idea is known as counter-expectation. Do not worry about the term. Just remember that it means that speakers use words to show that reality is going against or countering their expectations. English has many words that serve this purpose. Three of the most common are the words even, still, and actually. You will often hear them in casual, everyday speech. Speakers use these words to show surprise or disappointment. The pitch of their voice tells you what they mean. Let's study examples of each word.
Speakers often use the word even to show disappointment or surprise. Imagine a young child that expects a phone call from a family member, perhaps an uncle or grandparent. The phone call never comes. The child might say the following:
"What's wrong with him? He didn't even call me on Christmas Day."
Here, the child is expressing disappointment. She could have expressed the same idea in a much longer statement, such as, "I was expecting him to call on Christmas Day, but I didn't hear from him. Why didn't he give me a call?" Even highlights the child's disappointment because it emphasizes that the family member did not try to call. Even does not always have a sad meaning. It can have a happy meaning, too. Imagine a man named Ted. Ted is a forgetful man. He forgets to send letters or gifts to his parents. Ted's parents might have the following talk after they get a Christmas letter from him.
"Did you see Ted's letter?"
"Yeah, he even sent us a gift."
Here, the word even shows a pleasant surprise. Ted's mother did not expect a gift from him. By saying, "He even sent us a gift," she is suggesting that Ted has gone beyond her expectations.
Americans sometimes use still for showing how reality does not quite meet their expectations. Consider this example from the 1986 film Ferris Bueller's Day Off. At the end of the film, Ferris says the following lines. A different speaker might say similar lines after a lengthy, tiring, and disagreeable family Christmas party.
"You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go."
In the film, you can see the surprised look on Ferris's face. When he says, "You're still here?" you can tell he did not expect people to still be around. He is a little disappointed. Now, imagine a different situation. A family is having a Christmas dinner. They are looking for one family member, Uncle Bob. They wonder if he left without saying goodbye.
"Have you seen Uncle Bob?"
"No, did he leave? Wait, there he is. He's still here."
The way the final speaker says "still" shows that she is surprised to learn he was still at the dinner. She expected otherwise. A third common word that shows surprise or disappointment is actually. Actually suggests something is true, even when it differs from what might have been thought or expected. Remember Uncle Bob? Bob has always been a nice guy. Imagine Uncle Bob sees a Christmas present he likes and then runs away with it. A speaker might say,
I can't believe it. Uncle Bob actually stole her Christmas gift.
Here, the speaker uses actually to emphasize the unexpectedness of a happening. Uncle Bob stealing the present. She does not sound very happy. Speakers can use actually to show positive feelings, too. Think back to our character Ted, the guy who always forgets to give gifts for Christmas. His parents could have shown their surprise at receiving a gift from Ted by saying the following.
Ted actually gave us a gift.
Here, the word actually shows that they are pleasantly surprised at this strange happening. Ted remembered Christmas.
The next time you are listening to an English speaker, try to find examples of words that show counter expectation. Is the speaker expressing surprise or disappointment? How does the speaker change the pitch of their voice? By answering these questions, you will start to learn how English speakers communicate emotions in subtle ways.
Excuse me, John, are you still recording your show?
Yes.
You're still recording? We have to go to the Christmas party.
Oh, no. I had actually forgotten about that. And that's Everyday Grammar. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In March of 1889, Grover Cleveland left the White House after 4 years as president. He had been defeated by Benjamin Harrison. As they were leaving, Cleveland's wife, Frances, spoke with a member of the White House staff. She said, I want you to take good care of everything. I want to find it the same when we come back, and we will be back in 4 years. Frances Cleveland was right. She and her husband moved back into the White House after he became president again in 1893. Grover Cleveland is the only man to serve 2 terms separated by the administration of a different president. Shirley Griffith and Frank Oliver begin the story of Grover Cleveland's second presidency.
Grover Cleveland did not want to be president again, but he was worried about the future of the United States. He did not think President Harrison could solve the serious economic problems the country faced. President Harrison had approved very high taxes on imports. He also had approved an increase in the supply of silver money. Grover Cleveland said both actions had hurt the economy. He also feared that Harrison was not strong enough to oppose the demands of special interest groups in the Republican Party. Cleveland believed he was the only Democrat who could defeat Harrison. He won his party's nomination, and he was easily elected to a second presidency.
Grover Cleveland immediately turned to the nation's economic problems. The country seemed headed for a serious depression. Only a few days before Cleveland's second inauguration in 1893, a major railroad failed. Then, another big company declared failure. This set off a selling panic on the stock market. In the next few months, almost 8,000 businesses failed in the United States. 400 banks closed. 1 million workers lost their jobs. The prices of farm products fell lower than ever before, and thousands of farmers, unable to pay their debts, had to give up their farms.
Experts offered a number of different reasons for the depression. Some said it was a plot by members of the stock market to ruin farmers and seize their land. Some said it happened because American factories were producing more goods than people could use. Still others said the problem was caused by the government's money policy. For many years, the United States and other nations used both gold and silver as money. Paper money was used to represent a nation's gold and silver holdings. The value of silver was tied to the value of gold. In the United States in the early 1800s, 15 ounces of silver had the same value as 1 ounce of gold. This value did not change until after 1860. That was when mines in the western United States began to produce large amounts of silver. The extra silver caused the price of the metal to fall.
In 1871, Germany declared that it would no longer support its paper money with silver. Instead, it would use only gold. Other European countries quickly did the same thing. The United States did too. In 1873, Congress passed a law that stopped the government from using silver as money. Western silver producers protested. They put great pressure on lawmakers to change the law. 5 years later, Congress passed a compromise bill. The compromise bill said the government could issue limited amounts of silver money. It said the government must buy $2 million worth of silver each month for that purpose.
12 years later, during President Benjamin Harrison's administration, Congress passed a new silver purchase bill. It said the government must buy 4.5 million ounces of silver each month. The Treasury Department would buy the silver with new paper money that could be exchanged for silver or gold. The new law increased the amount of silver money used in the United States. The country soon became sharply divided on the issue of silver money. Wealthy businessmen and bankers did not want to use silver money at all. They wanted the country's economy to be based only on gold. This was what was known as the gold standard. They believed the gold standard would keep the value of the dollar high. Using silver, they said, made the dollar less valuable.
Farmers, laborers, and others wanted to use silver money, and they wanted an unlimited supply of it. Without silver, they said, the country's money supply would be too small. Gold would increase in value. People who had borrowed money would be hurt. They would have to pay back loans with dollars that were more valuable than those they had borrowed. President Cleveland supported the gold standard. He opposed any use of silver for money. He said the United States should use only gold, as other nations did.
President Cleveland was sure the Silver Purchase Law of 1890 had caused the economic depression. He explained the situation in this way. The law had caused businessmen and investors to lose faith in the government's money policy. They were afraid their money would drop in value as more silver money was put into use. Investors began to withdraw their money from businesses. Banks began demanding early payment of loans. Everyone wanted gold. They took their paper money and their silver to the government and exchanged them for gold. In 1890, when the Silver Purchase Act was passed, the government held almost $290 million in gold. After 2 years, withdrawals had cut that amount to $100 million.
President Cleveland and other administration officials began to worry. It was possible that gold holdings might fall so low the government could not support the dollar. Cleveland decided the only answer was to get Congress to kill the silver purchase law. Then the government could stop buying silver. It could return to the gold standard. The Congress was not in session, however. It would not meet again for several months. President Cleveland did not want to wait. He believed the problem was too serious. So he called a special session of Congress. The president did not expect an easy time with the Congress. Many congressmen supported silver money, especially those congressmen from silver-producing states in the West.
President Cleveland believed he could get Congress to kill the silver purchase law. But if he showed any weakness, the fight would be lost. Then, just before the congressional debate, he learned he would need an operation. He felt a rough spot in the top of his mouth. It got bigger and more painful. Doctors examined the spot. It was a cancer. President Cleveland asked how long he could wait to have the cancer removed. "If it were in my mouth," one of the doctors said, "I would have it removed immediately."
Cleveland agreed, but he said the operation would have to be kept secret. News from the White House often affected short-term activity on the stock market. News that the president's life was in danger could cause the nation's economic crisis to become worse. Cleveland decided to have the operation on a friend's boat in New York Harbor. Newsmen were told he was going sailing with his friend. Doctors made final preparations. They were not afraid of the operation, but they were afraid of what would happen if news of the operation were leaked to the press. One of them spoke with the boat's captain. "If you hit an underwater rock," he said, "hit it good and hard, so we will all go to the bottom."
As the boat moved slowly up the East River in New York, the doctors put President Cleveland to sleep with an anesthetic drug. Then they began the operation. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.